You're listening to The Strandcast, a student-run podcast in companion with Strand Newspaper at Victoria College, where two sleep-deprived and slightly close UT students discuss fake news and pop culture while exploring student connection, hardships, and renewal. I'm Carol Eugene Park, the podcast editor, and it's just me today. Happy Valentine's Day! This week's episode is a Valentine's Day special, and I really hope you enjoy. I invited some awesome guests to speak about love, self-love, and growth. Like many English majors, I experienced my love of literature when I was very young. I read any novel that I could get my hands on, visiting the library every day to borrow a ton of books. Character development intrigued me the most. I was enamored with how characters evolved and changed depending on various events in the storyline. During middle school, I discovered my love of young adult books, and this quickly became my one and only genre, because young adult books almost always dealt with a theme of romantic love. I quickly became obsessed with romance, love, and all things relationships. I could not get enough of it. Romantic love excited me, but it also frightened me. I started watching every romantic comedy movie, every romance movie, literally any medium that explored romantic love, I probably already had watched it. The irony of my adolescent infatuation was that I had no desire to experience romantic love. While many of my peers in middle school and high school wanted to find the one and fall in love, I was more interested in loving myself. I didn't want to love anybody else. I had no desire to. My dad says that I'm incredibly selfish, and in some ways I am. But if there's one thing I'm incredibly proud of, it's the fact that I am satisfied with myself, my relationship with God, and most importantly, I have the world's best support system. But I wasn't always proud of my singleness. In second year, my friends and I went to a party, and the party was fine, but an hour in, the red wine had kicked in, and I started to let my guard down, which then promptly led me to have an emotional breakdown. People who know me know that I rarely discuss my real feelings. I try to keep things surface level as much as possible, even in the midst of a serious conversation. I never let my guard down, and so I use sarcasm as my defense mechanism. But for whatever reason, that night of the party, I was incredibly insecure about the fact that I didn't want a romantic relationship, or romantic love for that matter. I remember leaving the frat house in tears, sobbing because I knew I was weird. What person doesn't want romantic love? Who doesn't want to experience falling in love? Well, me. I've known this for most of my life. I'm in love with the idea of love, and that's about it. I don't want to live its reality, just live vicariously through its stories. Growing up, though, everyone would say,
"You'll feel differently about marriage and kids when you meet the right person."
Some of my close friends still say that to me, and the level of frustration and annoyance I feel is indescribable. The inability of my peers in middle school and high school to accept me for the way I was made me incredibly insecure. I felt inadequate and an outcast. I hated that people dismissed my feelings and invalidated my view on what I wanted for myself. So there I was, sobbing on the steps of a frat house. My friend, who had never seen me cry, came over and tried to understand what was going on. What's wrong with me? Why don't I want to fall in love? Why don't I want a relationship? Why don't I want to have kids and get married? Everyone wants that. Looking back, though, my emotional breakdown makes me cringe. The thought of being vulnerable and sharing my insecurities still makes me feel uncomfortable. As dramatic and extra as my insecurity may sound, it was real. No one wants to feel like the black sheep of the family. No one wants to feel left out. No one enjoys feeling left out of the norm. And so here I am, in my fourth year, trying to grasp the reality that I will be graduating, entering the real world of adults and cultivating new relationships, and navigating through a space in which I will definitely be uncomfortable and will definitely be foreign. And I wonder if this feeling that I've had since as long as I can remember will dissipate. if truly I do meet someone, that the way I view love and its reality will change. And I don't really know. I mean, I love myself. Isn't that enough?
So I'm here with Mark. Mark is a fourth year student at Victoria College. What are you studying, Mark?
I'm a cinema studies specialist with a minor in English.
What got you interested in studying cinema?
I went to Humber College in the middle of my undergrad experience. I took a year off, I took many years off. But one of the years off, I went to Humber College enrolled in their first inaugural comedy writing and performance program. So that was a year doing that. So with that, I learned, as far as performing goes, I'm a writer. So, but it was fun. As many writers know, I think as you know, writing is really hard. And even if you're supposed to do it, it's very hard to sit down and do it. Once you're in it and you're in the zone, you're good. But it was really hard for me to sit down and do it. I think one thing that hurt me, and it's hurt me too in my undergrad revisited, is when someone tells me I'm good, I kind of freeze up. And it's almost like, I don't know if I'm afraid of success, but it doesn't help me. It's better for me to be striving and be humble and just thinking that I'm not very good. Then I seem to do better. But as soon as I get a compliment, I remember this past summer, the reason I decided to take the MA program, the director of the program knew my name. Mm-hmm. And this was told to me by an instructor who shouldn't have told me this. And they basically said, yeah, the director of the program knows you, who I've never even met until recently. And she said, you're very good. And it was a great compliment, and it made me decide I might be good enough for the MA program, because before, I just thought I was an okay student in cinema. So this sort of pushed me forward, but the next paper I had to write for him took me forever. I thought I had to be the best, and it was just like I had a reputation that I didn't know I had, and it was terrible. So that's hard, because once you're successful, then you freeze, but then you want to be successful. Mm-hmm. So I don't know I think you have to learn to navigate it.
From all your years at Vic, has there been one obstacle that you've had to overcome that really forced you to understand self-love?
My advice to anyone in their 20s is just be who you want to be. Because generally, everyone says, well, just be yourself. I don't believe in that at all. Like, you should just create who you want to be, especially if you're shy. Just decide, okay, well, I don't want to be shy. I don't want to be told I'm shy. And you don't want to live with regret. You don't want to be that person that didn't ask somebody out or didn't talk to somebody they should have. Get yourself a role model and envision yourself and force yourself into being who you want to be. That's what I think. Because your whole trajectory is about not just self-knowledge, but I think some sort of self-creation. Because you have to evolve and you have to change. So you might as well be someone you like. Because everyone seems to hate themselves.
In their 20s?
What?
In their 20s?
I think so. Or there doesn't seem to be any limit on people who are hard on themselves. And if you hate yourself or dislike parts of yourself, I just think it's so impossible. So, yeah, even if you're not quite sure you love yourself, just fake it. Push through. That's what I think. A lot of my experience at Vic, I think I'm a trailblazer in that I think I was one of the first out queer people at Vic. There was, I remember, a guy in North House. But back then, North House was just a little gay, because every house was different. Like, back in my day, like, South House was a party house, and then that slowly changed to Gate House. I was in Nell's House, in the lower houses. When I first got there, was the Jock House. It changed with the my year and the first years, who weren't athletic at all. So it sort of lost that reputation. It wasn't that hard for me. It wasn't like I was afraid for my life. No one threatened me. I think if people didn't like me, they just avoided me. Because I was a bit outspoken, and I was a bit of a blank disturber. Yeah, I kind of like to have fun with it, because it was the 90s and it was free. It was fun, but yeah, I was really lucky. I told people slowly as I came out, and then I think it was just over.
Has loving your nephew and caring for him expanded your experience of what self-love means?
Yes, because my nephew, when he was born, when Theodore was born, it was almost like falling in love. Because it was like, we had waited a long time for any kind of baby in the family. And when Theodore was born, there was a lot of anticipation, obviously. But it was almost like he and I connected from day one on this level that everyone kind of saw. And everyone was like my mother calls him my best friend. And I was kind of shook because I didn't expect to become attached to him like I did. And it was very strong, very immediate. And from day one, he's always gravitated to me. And it's like this mutual admiration club. And we're each other's like biggest fans. And it's very strong. And it still is because now he's 4.5. And I try so hard to treat both my nephews equally, but Theodore and I are BFFs, so it's hard. So yeah, it's taught me in terms of love to be very careful, because sometimes I lash out at people when I get upset, and I'm very careful not to lash out at the kids in any way. So even if I'm pissed, I still try to never hurt them in any way. Even to be dismissive, which I think can be really horrible for a kid, I just don't do that because I don't want to ever hurt them in any way. But that's like being protective, I think. But yeah, it's a whole different level of love. Because obviously I'm not in love with them, but it's completely strong and bizarre. But it's good because I find myself, because as you know, they're moving to Vancouver and the whole idea is being very upsetting. And I've had to emotionally compartmentalize it because I'm busy with school. So I almost emotionally can't deal with it. So I sort of put it to the back. And when I get angry about it, I just sort of mistreat my brother because it's like his issue. Because he got a great new job, so they're moving to Vancouver. So, of course, not to berate him, but at the same time, I'm just, like, so upset. You know, that's life. And it's taught me, you know, they're not mine. They're their parents. But they'll always know their Uncle Mark and that I'm always there for them. So, like, when they're 14 and they hate their parents, they can come and stay with me. And when they get a cell phone, they can text me. And they know all these things, so I'm not really worried, even though I'm heartbroken. I know that it'll all come back in the end, but I just don't know what city we'll be in. So it's very sad. I don't want him to see it hit me, but I'm scared what's going to happen when I'm alone here with my mom. Because being a caregiver is not always easy, and I think I'm just going to, I don't know, I think it's going to hit me then, and that I'm going to be... I find myself having to distance myself emotionally. I'm trying not to distance myself physically. Like, I know they want to hang out, and I try not to say no, even though it's becoming painful. But that's life. So, I wouldn't have been able to deal with this in my 30s. I think in my 20s and 30s, I was still a party boy. I wasn't ready to go back to school. I don't think I was ready to be in a proper relationship, not that I'm in one now. I don't think I was ready to be a caregiver or an uncle. It was like I had to turn 40 to kind of grow up. So it's been an interesting journey. I don't know what the 50s will be like. But they're soon, because I'm going to be the oldest, not the oldest, but I'm going to be quite an old addition to the class of 2018. I don't know if I'll be the oldest, but who knows? Theodore is he's very funny in that he's a lot like me, in that sometimes he's very like a little distant and a little bit mature, and like his brother's more of the comedian, and he's more like loving, while Theodore's kind of like, he doesn't give it up for free. he's very discerning, and he's kind of like you. He has to decide when he's going to be affectionate. Like to me, when he's affectionate, he puts his hand on my arm. It's not hugging. It's not. Or he'll like jump on me, but that's kids. But that's him being affectionate, but physically, like sort of touching me gently, very casual. While his other brother is more like, you know, hugs and kisses and more affectionate. But Theodore is very, he's a very cool character. And I've said to other people, I'm like, don't chase after him. He has to come to you. Otherwise, you're just going to freak him out. That's a pretty good form of love. The family bond there. And I love the fact that I'm such an influence and I'm not a parent. I'm not their guardian. Even though the roles have reversed in a lot of ways, being a caregiver, caregiver is hard because you still have to respect them. You can't just make them do what you want. You have to still be like, okay, you're my parent. So, you know, there is some respect, obviously. So not that there isn't respect the other way, but it's different. They're allowed to get mad at me. I'm not really supposed to get mad at them, you know. But sometimes that happens. You try not to, but that's like...
In the future, do you have any plans on perhaps living a heteronormative lifestyle of getting married and having children?
I don't know. I'm not against it because I don't want to sound like I have an agenda or a plan. I think if I meet somebody, and this scares me a little bit, I think if I meet like somebody great, I'll think that this is the one, and it'll all happen very quickly. It'll all be like cohabitating, and then possibly having some sort of monogamous affair, like a marriage or some sort of union. I don't know about adopting kids, because parenting scares me because I've seen it as a guest star, and I'm scared it is a lot of work. I don't think I can handle when they're a teenager and they hate you. I think it would break my heart, like more than anything in the world. So I don't know. I think I'm ready, finally, and I'm scared it's all going to happen very fast. But then I'm also logical, and maybe not everything is meant to last forever. And you can grow out of people, and maybe monogamy isn't always perfect. The perfect union for everybody. I mean, I think it works really well for some people. But I'm also not crazy about the open relationship concept, because I think there is jealousy, and that exists. So I'm afraid it's complicated. Unfortunately, but I'm open, so.
Hey, Manfred.
Hey, Carol.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty well.
What does self-love mean to you, Manfred?
I think it's a journey, a process, and most importantly, being kind to yourself and knowing your limits to what you can do.
What do you identify as?
I identify as a queer male living in the 21st century.
Would you say that as a queer man, your journey of self-love is different to, let's say, a cis man?
Definitely. Growing up, my identity has always been challenged by family, peers, society, and I was forced to learn how to cope with that. And because of those circumstances, I almost lived outside of society expectations just because I realized who I am goes against it just because I'm such an effeminate male. And I stick out like a sore thumb, just like many other LGBTQ people outside. When I was younger, I would just cry, but now that I'm older, I would do the things that make me happy. It sounds pretty obvious, but we gotta be kind to ourselves and know our limits.
What obstacle or situation has forced you to re-examine how you love yourself?
Just like many other people, a breakup. Like many of us, I tend to overthink and begin to think about your own self-identity, your own self-worth, and it piles on to this whole downward spiral where you're just constantly thinking about if you're enough, if what you have to offer is valuable at all, and their opinion should not weigh in that much.
In what ways has that person changed your mentality on love in general?
It was quite transformative. I didn't know that felt that good, you know? Love is not overrated. Love is definitely not overrated. I think that's my conclusion. And it was just so beautiful, and you know, I still reminiscent about it, but I think it has taught me so much more new things, and it's just a powerful journey that we should all allow ourselves to experience and feel.
When you were with this person, did you find yourself projecting your insecurities onto your significant other at the time?
No, not necessarily. You know what? You're right. Yeah, I did. Yeah, and it's hard, difficult, just because when you have that much insecurity inside of you, that's how you assume, that's how everybody thinks as well. And in order to overcome that, you need to get out of your head, and it's on you, to be honest. And you gotta have that kind of conversation within your own head to identify those insecurities. You need to find ways to overcome them. The theme is process, and don't be too hard on yourself, and to understand that like these things don't get solved overnight.
Would you mind sharing your experience of understanding your sexuality?
Up to 13 years old, I had no idea, despite being clearly attracted to males. Never had that conversation in my head, never had the resources available around me for me to realize my orientation. And not until I had gone back to Vancouver from living in Hong Kong, I had no knowledge of even being aware that I could be. Somebody online had asked me if I were gay or I was bisexual, and my first immediate reaction was, no, of course not. Like, what do you mean? And then they're like, what? They're just so confused because I think they got so many different cues. And then until then, I never thought about it. And I think that was kind of this pivotal moment in my life where I started to re-examine everything. Slowly but surely, I came to realize that I was attracted to males.
One of the common narratives that I've heard from a lot of my friends who identify as gay, they say that they ask themselves, why me? And I don't know if this is like a common thing, but did you ever have that?
Why me? Yeah, honestly, that's so true. In some sense, you do feel like you've been put under a curse just because being gay is quite difficult, you know, not knowing who you are and having to figure that out all by yourself, knowing the potential of being rejected by your own family, society, friends, it's incredibly stressful and scary, considering that most of us have to go through that at 12, 13, when growing up is already hard enough, and you just feel like you're just unfortunate. But it is a very unique experience, and I believe that it gives us a interesting perspective of the world and allow us to live above society norms, giving us a more interesting life.
Based on your relationship this past year, how would you say that you have grown as a person?
I would like to think that I've become a little bit more self-aware. My last year, my goal is to be a little bit, to be a kinder person. And I think I've in some way achieved that. And my mouth is very loose. So, you know, I talk a lot and sometimes I say like hurtful things. And last year was the year where I tried to be a little bit more self-aware and know my limits when it is appropriate or when it is not appropriate to say certain things. And I definitely have seen a change in how that has affected my relationship with other people.
Would you say that there is a correlation between being kind to others and loving yourself?
It's so easy for us to project our own thought process onto others and believing that's how the world functions and how the entire population operates on. And when you are always so self-critical of others, you begin to project that right back onto yourself, and it's so easy for you to become self-conscious and develop a low self-worth. And for someone to achieve a high level of self-love, I guess one must first be kind to yourself and others.
So I was talking to a friend who identifies as, and they said that within the LGBTQ community there is a hierarchy, and I didn't really understand what they meant by that, but
oh wow.
They did say that, I mean, race played a factor.
Now you make me, you just clowned me right there. Yeah, yeah, let me backtrack real quick. Yeah, race plays a huge. Yeah, no, now that you brought that up, it's just because I haven't been on dating apps for a while. I'm kind of removed from that, like, racial hierarchy, I guess. Yeah, it definitely is a thing on, in the gay community, which is quite unfortunate. It's not uncommon to see some guy's biography that says no femmes, no Asians, no blacks, and it justified as a preference instead of calling what it is, discrimination.
Within feminism, not all feminists believe this, but I am part of a group that believes that in order for women to be equal, we have to tear down the patriarchy, and we have to start from scratch. Within the LGBTQ community, and in order to get rid of all of the discrimination that happens within, what do you think needs to be dealt with first?
Well, firstly, I'd like to object that we need to tear down everything in order for progress to be made. You know, I'm going to speak my truth. I don't think that's feasible, and that's not necessarily good. I believe that change and reform can be made within. Change is always slow, and I think we need to work within the system to enact change, just because I don't think destruction or the sudden disruption or revolt is necessarily the best way to go. Well, I believe that education and raising awareness is a much more rational way to do things. I do understand that some people can get quite impatient with how slow progress can be made, but I think the Me Too movement and the Time's Up Me Too movement have exemplified that reform is coming, changes can be made, and that the rigidness of the institution can be moved. It can only happen through conversations, and people everywhere need to mobilize and speak up and contest with the norm or the status quo.
What advice would you give your younger self?
To quote a wise man who once said, "If you can't love yourself, how the hell are you gonna love somebody else?" RuPaul's Drag Race is on VH1 and OutTV if you're in Canada, so support your community. Yeah, I guess that would be it. Honestly, you know, as a cliche as it sounds, I'm gonna learn it the hard way or the easier way, either way, and I won't change a thing.
Thank you, Manfred, for joining me.
No problem, Carol. It was a pleasure talking with you.
So my name is Jasmine Ng.
I'm David Baldridge.
So David, what's your cultural background?
My father is of European heritage. My mother is the daughter of Chinese immigrants. So yeah, that's my cultural background. And you?
I'm full Chinese. My parents moved over in the 80s, and they actually went to school in Western universities. My father in Iowa and my mother in Australia. We're kind of an interesting mix of East and West. I was wondering, when did your family actually, the Chinese side of your family, move over?
Both my grandparents on that side, actually, they came fleeing. My grandfather fleeing from the Japanese occupation, my grandmother fleeing from the communist revolution in the 1940s. So obviously that's some time ago relative to your family.
So do you find that there's a bit of a kind of cultural difference between those who moved over earlier than as opposed to your more contemporary immigrants?
Well, I think obviously for people like myself, especially people like myself, given that ethnically I'm half European and I don't speak a word of any Chinese dialect, I can't understand any. I feel compared to, say, somebody like you, you speak Cantonese quite fluently. I perhaps have less of a connection to China as a whole, and I think that makes sense.
Do you ever feel like you're Chinese? Like, I think that's kind of like
interesting. maybe this is just as a kind of multiracial person, but especially when I was young, I had a very difficult time trying to understand that there was differences in race. It was something that I only came to realize gradually as I had these unusual experiences, like something my family would do often is we'd go for dim sum on the weekends, and I thought, well, this is just something that everybody does. Did you ever have anything
yeah,
like
I
that?
Kind of, I thought it was interesting. When I was in elementary school, they actually made me play at recess with a new kid who only spoke Cantonese. So they singled out me and another child so that they said, like, you two have to play with this child. So it was kind of interesting because that was the, like, one time I realized that actually my Chinese was actually not as fluent as I had previously imagined. They just grouped us arbitrarily on this, like, one trait and then and expected us to go forth.
You might ask, how did that make you feel?
I found it made me feel extremely insecure. I think for the most part, I have very much prided myself on being Chinese. But then again, when it comes to actually, you know, speaking the language, it makes me nervous because I'm always measuring myself against other people.
So would it be fair to say almost sometimes you're a little bit self-conscious about being too connected to China maybe? And sometimes you're self-conscious about not being connected enough to China? Is that...
Yeah, I think so. Because I think I remember when I was later in elementary school, when you'd grown up a little bit, it was middle school, I think, and people would say things like, oh, you're very pretty for an Asian. And I found that to be kind of jarring and kind of, I don't know, disheartening because it felt like there was like a different category of pretty that you could only occupy because you could never reach the other true level of pretty that, like, or smart or you know, talented. Then they would also like group you, like they'd say like, oh well, Asians are good at math, so like this is just how it is. Like, you're not special because you're just occupying a different level of smart that is, like, you know, the default. Did you have that?
Given that I'm previously mentioned half European, it's different. It's an unusual experience because people will sometimes mistake me for being not Asian at all or fully Asian sometimes. Mm-hmm. Given the fact that I don't appear necessarily to be Asian, perhaps I don't. This is not something that I experience quite as often.
Mm-hmm. I think maybe it's like not as prevalent in your everyday life. But then again, like, we had Chinese New Year dinner together.
Yeah.
I think, and I was like, I think that was like, I feel like that's like one of the best ways to kind of keep in contact with your cultural background. I think it's just like the food.
Well, yeah, the food is always good.
So I, you know, honestly, I think for me it was like very difficult because there were Chinese people and then there were like Western people. I guess like in my mind to be very to the extreme. And so for people who are Chinese, I was not Chinese enough. Sometimes I would have an accent, so I'd have trouble switching between languages and then I'd have an accent in either language. And then with the Western people, I was very clearly different from them. So there was never really a way, like there's only the middle ground to occupy. And I found that to be...
Middle grounds are always tough to find.
Because it was hard to identify with people from either group. Because my parents learned English quite fluently, they speak English quite fluently, I haven't had, like, there's no real need to express myself in Chinese. So it's been really tough trying to, like, push myself to continue using Chinese with them.
Well, it's interesting because I know for my mother, her parents, if not actively, discouraged her from using Cantonese because they feared that they would not adapt and be able to speak English. And so that they learned English through their daughter, who, by attending school, learned English, spoke to them in English, which allowed them to, you know, conduct business. And
my grandfather died when I was fairly young, so when I was 4. Mm. And I think there was a real gap between myself and my brother. Because my brother's about 2 years older than me. And because they spent so much more time with him, my grandparents, he learned a lot more than me. So he can actually, you know, my Chinese is conversational, you know, at best, sometimes I feel. But he has a much wider vocabulary and he's allowed to, he can express a much wider range of ideas. There is no way for one to undo those events of time. Those are just, you know, due to chance. Yeah. But I think that, like, that was a very important thing. I think my friends have also said this. Other friends have said that staying in contact with one's grandparents has a great effect on, like, one's cultural identity, like, ability to speak the language. Being in English schools early on in my childhood also allowed me to actually develop a very competent grasp of English, so I think it also helped me in some other ways, you know? Well, like, David, you'd never really had that much trouble fitting in ever, did you?
It's true, yeah. Partly because of appearances. And I mean, it does beg the question if over time, there is this kind of erosion of connection, if that phrase makes any sense. This kind of, the connection to, say, China for Chinese immigrants, it will, of course, degrade over time as generation to generation goes on. The language connection starts to be reduced. And so to some degree, I think it's very, very hard to preserve as deep a connection as your parents had. But that being said, I still feel very much to be half Chinese. I mean, I celebrate the Lunar New Year. I have interacted with many of my Chinese relatives. So although, as you were talking about with like language and stuff, the connection does tend to be reduced. It's up to the person themselves to decide how much they want to keep that connection up. They can make their own decisions about who they want to be. I think certainly ethnic background is something that one does consider. It's an impossible topic to get away from. I don't speak any Chinese, but if I really, really wanted to, I could definitely make an effort to pick up the language.
Yeah, I suppose there's a bit of this strange idea of what like authentic Chinese is, yeah. Or authentic anything is. Well, I suppose that authenticity isn't really what we're seeking. Like, authenticity is something that only you can really define for yourself. I think race and ethnicity are important factors in defining oneself. So it is valuable to maintain a connection to one's culture, but ultimately it is up to the individual to decide who they are.
I think that's what we should all strive for.
Self-love is reminding yourself that there's something greater than you. Like there is the individual, but your life touches so many others. And I think self-love is reminding yourself that connections that you make, people may not remember what you say, what you do, but you do make them feel something. Whatever lives you touch, you always change them, and they are affecting you as well. Remembering that and your importance in the world, no matter how small your change is, that's self-love.
Has there been a person or an event that has made you rethink how you think about love?
Yeah, I think so. I remember I had a very, very close friend, and when I first met her, I just felt like, wow, there's a person who, you know, above all other people, understands me the best. Like, I felt that we were emotional and intellectual equals. And I think what I did was kind of put all my friend eggs into one friend basket. And that is a regrettable choice. But at that moment, I felt like that it was something truly worth it. So I would often find myself saying to her, you're my only friend, you're like my one true friend. And I think, first of all, that is problematic because really I had other friends. I was disregarding the good friendships and relationships that I had with other people, considering her to be above all else. And second of all, I was really underselling myself, because I was telling myself that I was dependent on someone else. I was saying that, you know, we were to have one whole. There is like somehow there's like an incompletion in both of us. That's how we like fit together. And I think there was actually one moment where she stopped talking to me, and I was very taken aback by this. And when I finally, after I think maybe a month and a half of this, I asked her what was wrong, she told me that the reason why she felt like she needed to pull away from me was because, not because we were actually too dependent on one another, it was that she said I was too busy to listen to any of her problems, or I was too busy being successful so I wouldn't understand what she was going through. It was a very strange predicament to me, because I always thought that the two of us were sole confidants in this world. We like understood one another. But this was a moment where I realized that I had actually been blind to the situation that we were in. So what I thought was the happiest relationship that I had, it was actually for her too much pressure to bear. I think she felt like there was too much at stake. And so that was like the one friendship where, you know, I realized that this is where you have to like remember that many, many relationships create your life. You can't put all the emphasis on one. It is damaging to both people, and it also is unfair.
The one thing I think I was naive about coming to university was that, I don't know where I had this idea, but I thought there was some kind of like objective truth for everything that could just be like, I didn't obviously say that, but I thought, you know, oh, I'll be at university, and then when I'm finished, I will know all that I need to know. Learn to accept that the more you know about yourself and about the world, it doesn't get easier to understand, it just gets more complicated. And that, don't be scared by that, because that's just how it is for everyone.
So thank you for listening. My name is Jasmine Ng.
Yeah, and I'm David Baldridge.
Thank you for listening to The Strandcast. A big thanks to Mark, Manfred, Jasmine, and David for contributing to the conversation. If you have an interesting story you want to share, please contact me at strandcast@thestrand.ca. This week's episode was written, produced, and edited by Carol Eugene Park. The Strandcast was made possible by collaborating with Vic Records.